Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Attention, collectors of vinyl, have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as though he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Creative Control with Vish Khanna.
Chandler Levac is a talented film critic, screenwriter, and director based in Toronto, Ontario. A contributor to the Globe and Mail and a Canadian National Magazine nominee, Levac has also received nominations for her work directing music videos, and her 2017 short film, We Forgot to Break Up, screened at the Toronto International Film Festival and at South by Southwest. Levac's directorial feature-length debut is a brilliant one called I Like Movies, and after winning hearts at select film festivals and acclaim from critics, it is currently screening in theaters across Canada. Chandler and I caught up recently to discuss this brilliant autobiographical new film, I Like Movies, her Toronto life and family history, her work as a cultural critic and how it informs her work now as a filmmaker, wanting to be a cool teen and a cool adult, the compelling story and wonderful cast of I Like Movies, loving Saturday Night Live and its role in this film, speaking out against misogyny and sexism in popular culture industries, regionalism and telling Canadian stories, receiving fervent and generous support from Sarah Pauly, exciting future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol. Plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. This is episode 762 of Creative Control, featuring the brilliant storyteller and filmmaker Chandler Levesque, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Chandler. How's it going?
Good. How are you, Vish?
I'm well. I'm very well. I noticed you plugged your nose as you said my name, like you were trying to create like a helium effect. Was that on purpose?
No, I just...
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling really good, Vish. How are you doing?
Yeah, that's my nose became weirdly itchy as soon as I said your name. I don't know what that means.
Sorry to call attention to your touching of your nose. No, it's nice to see you. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Toronto, Ontario.
Oh, Toronto. I was watching a Raptors game a night or two ago with my family, because that's what we do. We gather around the television and watch Raptors games. Anyway, they had this shot of Toronto. They had a shot of the Gardner, of all things. And I was like, oh, I miss Toronto, because I used to visit Toronto all the time. But I also didn't like... Do you like living in Toronto? Because I talked to a lot of people from Toronto now, and they're like, I want out. And people are... There seems to be some sort of minor exodus. Are you enjoying Toronto life?
The publication Toronto.
The magazine, yeah. For those around the world, I did a little mistake there. Yeah. Life in Toronto, I suppose?
Yeah. I feel like Toronto has changed so much. I mean, you and I kind of lived through the same era of like the Torontopia era. And I feel like the kind of creative energy that people used to have towards, you know, independent music and art and theater making and filmmaking has just been totally transposed towards like opening up a hipster banh mi shop. Like there's just, the city is in such a dark place in terms of capitalism and despair. And I feel like it's a really dark time to be living in Toronto as any kind of person who wants to make independent art. Like it's devastating.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound good. The second part of my somewhat convoluted question was, or maybe the subtext, if I didn't say that right, is have you thought about skipping town, going somewhere else?
I do think about it. I think I'm at a strange period of my life. You know, I'm 36, so I'm kind of like confused about, where I sort of want maybe the next part of my life to follow. And I love Montreal so much, and that's a city that I feel a deep affinity with and kind of have lived on and off in over the last decade. But it's also a really hard city to actually live in if you're an Anglophone. And so there's a part of me, I feel like every 3.5 years I have this kind of Saturn Returns moment where I like move to Montreal for like 3 months, get my heart like absolutely decimated. And then I come back with kind of my tail between my legs. And then, 3.5 years later, I'm like delusional enough to like start it all over again. But that city really has a real psychic hold on me. Like all Torontonians, I aspire to move to New York one day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think about that, too, because I really feel like when I connect with that city so much and when I'm there, sometimes I feel like I'm like a better version of myself. Maybe I'm a bit freer than I can be in Toronto where, you run into like 9 people just walking down the street every day. It's like a small town kind of in a big city. But I also love Toronto very deeply. My family's here. There's so many amazing institutions like TIFF and
the Globe and Mail and just people in my life that have really been supportive to me and that I've found to have a career in. And, you know, it's I feel like when I leave and travel and then I come back to Toronto, I always am like so grateful that I'm here.
Yeah. You've said a number of things there that I want to follow up on. And I just want to make note of them before I forget. Vocationally, I just want to, for those who don't know, I want to kind of get at that a little bit. What you consider your job, because right now, as we're speaking, we're talking about a beautiful, funny, intense film you made. I like movies, and I can't wait to talk more about where that came from and all those sorts of things. You mentioned the Globe and Mail. You mentioned the Toronto International Film Festival, associated with you in a few different ways. So I want to get into all of those things, but first things first, you mentioned you have family in Toronto. Are you from Toronto? Did you move to Toronto? Where are you from?
I was born in Toronto. My family all settled in Kensington Market kind of in the late 50s, early 60s after surviving the Holocaust. And they still own a building in Kensington to this day. And my mom actually lives there and is a landlord in Kensington Market.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of like where our roots were. And then I grew up kind of, I was born at like Bath, Christie and St. Clair. And then when I was five, we moved to Brantford, Ontario, which is, you know, where the telephone was invented and Wayne Gretzky was born there. It's also, I think, Ontario's capital of teen pregnancy. So it has many lauded accomplishments to its name.
Yeah.
And then when I was in grade five, when I was 10, we moved to Burlington, which is where my film is set.
Yeah.
And that's kind of where I spent, you know, my like preteens and all of my high school experience. And then I moved back to Toronto for university. So I've been living here since 2004.
Wow. Okay.
On and off. Yeah.
I've heard and read stories about families who survived the Holocaust. I did not know that was the case for your family. The generation you're from, is it possible to articulate what that means to you to know that's in your lineage, that that's something that was part of your family history?
Yeah, it was my grandfather. He was in Hungary in a concentration camp. And then he actually kind of reunited with all his siblings in Toronto. They all kind of escaped and came back here. So it is kind of an amazing story. Yeah, I mean, I always felt like a really strong connection to my Jewish heritage. I'm only like a quarter Jewish, but I did go on birthright. And I don't know, I was always like really, really fascinated with that. And I remember I would go to like Passover services or, you know, a friend bar mitzvah. And I remember like telling my grandma, like, I really want to be Jewish. I think that I am Jewish. And she was like, bad things happen to Jewish people. And at the time, I didn't know what that meant because I was only about, you know, five or six. And then later, I kind of found out what my grandfather had gone through and those experiences. And I don't know. It's interesting because I think my mom's half Jewish and she doesn't consider herself Jewish at all. And she doesn't celebrate any of the traditions. And she really feels like estranged from that part of identity. And I think for my grandfather, especially, he never wanted to celebrate like any of the holidays. He didn't really go to any, you know, temples or services or anything. Although I heard kind of towards the end of his life, he was kind of rekindling more of that aspect of himself. But it was always kind of like a source of like shame in my family, I guess.
Shame or trauma?
Obviously both, yeah.
Yeah, sorry. I know they're not...
It's a heavy note to start this podcast on.
Well, I'm sorry. You invoked it and I don't know. There's obviously very dark aspects of this film as well. Existential crisis, existential dread. So there's the heaviness in the film that I'm just wondering if you're tapping into that that part of your family history even a little bit of despair and what the hell am I doing? What was the purpose of life? Because I think that goes on a lot in this very funny movie. It's a very funny movie, but it's also, I assume you would agree, it's more than tinged with darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's...
Yeah, I think that's something I'm always trying to maybe explore in stuff that I do, this idea of things that are both like very, very funny and have very broad like jokes and stuff. But then, I don't know, I think obviously that kind of generational trauma is inherited and passed down and kind of filters through osmosis through like generations and stuff. And as I keep writing, and I'm just always so fascinated in, you know, my parents' experiences, my grandparents' experiences. Yeah. I really want to tell stories about my family. I don't know how they feel about that, but it's so fascinating to me. You know, I feel like a very strong connection to that part of my family and to my grandfather and what he went through.
Well, I mean, I got about 9 years on you, but I feel like you're probably getting into that time frame where you're of your life, rather the age, I guess is what I meant to say there, not time frame, but your age is, you're at a point where you're like, okay, looking ahead, I'm at a point where there's not going to, like, you know, you probably get into that zone of like, what's the future going to be like? How long am I going to be around? Kind of stuff. That stuff kind of comes into your brain. But I think particularly from us, my wife and I, you know, as parents and having children, time becomes this weird thing because we're seeing little mm-hmm. reflections of ourselves emerge in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's mm-hmm. making me think about, you're kind of forced to think about your history. And how you were raised, yeah. Am I doing something that my parents did to me that I didn't like? I better be more conscious of that. Or what would my parents mm-hmm. do in this situation? You know, you start to have this weird, and then as, I don't know about you, but my parents are getting older and mm-hmm. I'm having to, hey, have you done your exercises? Have you eaten yet? Why are you eating dinner so late? Now I'm quasi from afar parenting them. I'm just saying, yeah, you're probably at the same, I'll ask you, like, do you feel like in the middle of something right now at your age? Like with your parents, with your future, with yourself? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not that you're middle, absolutely. I guess you are technically middle-aged. Are we middle-aged? I think I'm middle-aged.
I'm 36, so please don't let me be middle-aged. Come on. I'm still unhinged, you know.
Sorry about that. Anyway, are you feeling that a little bit? Like, even as you ponder this movie and what yeah. the parents are going through and this, and we'll get to it in a second. Even this manager character is older but young mm. and yeah. trying to figure themselves out and then dealing with this kid who is – she sees – her promise in his future kind of thing. Anyway, you see what I'm talking about? It's like a swirl of temporal confusion.
Absolutely. I mean, so interesting. I mean, I spent most of the pandemic living with my dad, which I did not expect was going to happen to me, you know, at his place in Burlington, Ontario. So for about a year and a half, you know, it was just me and my dad, like, spending every night together, like, and all day together, because, you know, he was working from home and I was just working on this film. And so, yeah, it was really strange to kind of go back into an environment where, like, you're living with your parent again, but you're actually an adult and all you have is, like, free time to kill and you can't yeah. leave the house. Like, I never thought I would be, you know, it really felt like being a child again, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, and also just, I guess, yeah, I think, I mean, that's such a strange part when you start to realize that your parents are people. And then the kind of, like, as you get older, you know, and then as you get even older, then you're starting to parent your parents, which yeah. I can see myself doing now. Yeah, my dad's losing his hearing. He's, like, kind of going deaf. So that's mm-hmm. a bit devastating. But, yeah, he wears AirPods and he puts them on conversation mode. So instead of wearing hearing aids, so he just always looks like he's, like, you know, about to go to the gym or right. like, take a phone call.
Right. That's kind
of like a constant iPod commercial.
That's kind of clever, actually, if you've got some vanity and you don't want to be seen. Yeah, my dad's lost his hearing a long time ago or in one ear, and it's a yeah. battle. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, it's like, did you ever read that book, The Velveteen Rabbit?
It sounds familiar, actually. I don't think so, but it sounds like maybe it's in the house. No, I don't. I'll say no. I'll answer no.
Yeah, it's just sort of starting to feel like all the people in my life, like my parents and my parents' dog, who's in the movie, who's very elderly, and my grandma, like, they're all these, like, kind of, like, well-loved stuffed animals that are, like, all the fur is kind of falling off them, and you're just trying to, like, hug them so tight because you don't want them to leave.
Yeah. This is a heavy beginning to this conversation, but it's, I think, like, again, I feel like some of this is swirling on in the film as well. I said I wanted to ask you a little bit about your vocation. Obviously we're here to talk, your vocational pursuits. You mentioned a couple of organizations that I think you're affiliated with or have worked with. Chandler, how would you characterize what it is you do for work, beyond filmmaking now?
Yeah, I guess I would say I do some copy editing and writing and work still as kind of a cultural critic and film writer. So
journalist,
despite the horrible conflict of interest, I'm trying to eke out a living as both a filmmaker and a film critic, which
conflict of interest can be an interesting concept in cultural work, I find, because I too got into music by playing it, because that was what I really wanted to do, and then as I got older, I discovered I could write about it. And then, yes, you're criticizing your peers, or you want to be peers with the people you're criticizing. And sometimes I slip into that even on this show, where if I'm talking to a musician or I'm talking to someone like yourself, I can say, yeah, I know what it's like to write, and I made records, like I know what that's like. So I don't know if it's conflict of interest or just like kinship, or obviously I'm part of your, you feel like you're wanting to be part of the same realm, I guess. Is that a way of putting it?
I mean, you would think that both those things would actually make you better and more equipped to kind of both connect with the people you're interviewing and also, critically evaluate someone's work, someone's art, because, I feel like having made a film, it's made me so much more empathetic as a film critic. I think especially when I was really young, I kind of grew up in that sort of like Vice magazine style of writing where it was all about like voice and affect and the harsher you were on something or the more audacious you were on the way that you were viewed it or sensationalistic or coarse, like that was the style of writing back then. And I think criticism it's incredibly insane how much criticism has changed over when I first started doing it in 2004, like literally in my first year of university to now. I mean, the whole conversation of how to evaluate art and who gets to make it is really, everything's being called into question right now. And even just the validity of professional arts criticism in a world where, you can access like 900 reviews as soon as a movie premieres at a film festival on Letterboxd, or how Twitter kind of like forms the cultural consensus of something immediately after the first press release drops. Like, it's wild.
It is pretty wild. Some of us refer to it as the democratization of criticism. And then you're like, yeah, but is democracy really working? Like what are we doing right now? So you're feeling even a little existential dread in terms of that work that you do. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of, pandemic or no, I feel like there is a lot of like, what are we doing nowadays? Like in every realm, just like, what is the point of this? And I feel like it maybe is informed by the fact that the earth is trying to get rid of us by making the water bad or high levels, or making the air problematic. Every couple months, there's a new thing in the air we're not supposed to breathe. Air and water, pretty essential. I'm pretty sure we're supposed to have the air and the water. So that's where is that swimming around, do you think? Just like a common low level, not even, I used to say during the pandemic, there's just low level stress every day. Is it mid-level stress every day of just like, what the hell are we doing? Like, do you have that a little bit?
Yeah, in a weird way, I found the pandemic kind of liberating, because I was really going through a kind of bad spout of depression right before it. So in a way, having everything, obviously it was a horrible, tragic experience for everybody to go through, that I think it's still going to take many years for us to all process the kind of chaotic trauma that sort of period induced. But I think also just having it really took the pressure off of having to kind of perform or achieve anything or go to social events. Or I think I was just really feeling like so much depression and social anxiety at that time, so in a strange way I was kind of grateful to just get an excuse to live with my dad and not feel like a failure or something. And as sort of a freelancer who works from home, I was like, now everyone's just living my lifestyle.
I know. Yeah, I was enjoying, I am still enjoying that aspect of things, because I find commuting. God, I used to commute from Guelph to Toronto, and it literally, Chandler, I would take a laptop at 5:30 in the morning and get on a train. And then at 8, I would arrive at Union Station, and I would go to the office that I worked for at the time, and I'd plug in the same laptop. And then I would, at the end of the day, go home. Not home till 6 or 7, My child was just, you know, my wife and my child. I was like, this is, it's the same. What do we, anyway, sorry. This is, I have found what I'm frustrated by in terms of this weird zone we're in where we're not really post-pandemic, but things are sort of normal again is I thought we would learn a lot about efficiencies and what are we doing wasting our time? Because I do feel like time, it's part of your movie. I think time is just moving on. And this is what we get stressed about. Like, well, how are we maximizing our time? What are we doing with our time? Does that resonate with you?
Yeah, I think also just kind of the social media, you know, so much of just kind of observing other lives on screen and just need to constantly be like, I exist, I exist, I exist. Like, that's also quite gross.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. It is weird. And I'm not sure if there's we're not going to resolve this today. I like to say that on the show. Like, you and I are not going to solve this, but I do think it's worth invoking. I want to ask you a little bit about your interest in film and where it came from. Because obviously, as we've discussed, in almost every aspect of your working life, film is a constant, it seems to me. How did you get into films?
I mean, it really is just kind of the origin story of this movie that I made. You know, I think there is just a certain point when I was kind of an early teenager where, I don't know, I just started like watching movies with this kind of fervor and intensity. I mean, it was kind of, it was everything. It was also music and art and just culture and really just kind of defining myself like by the things that I liked, like my taste, you know, because I think before that I was just kind of like fed things that were like marketed to teenage girls in the, you know, late to mid 90s and early aughts, which were not so great. It was pretty like devastating time to be a teenage girl and a preteen girl back then because there wasn't a lot of fantastic media. So, you know, it was just like watching like She's All That and, you know, 10 Things I Hate About You, and which is a great movie. But and I was just addicted when I was a sort of a preteen to anything that would tell me what a teenager was going to be like, you know, because I hadn't really experienced anything, but I was addicted to media, TV shows, films, books that could tell me what my life as a teenager was supposed to be like. And I just loved those books and movies. So like Dawson's Creek, you know, was like a humongous show for me. And I watched that. It started when I was in grade 6 and then it ended, I think, in grade 10. So I watched it for my entire adolescence and obsessively. And I think there's something about popular culture, maybe when you're a bit alienated, that it kind of almost makes you feel nostalgic for experiences that you've never had.
Yeah.
And it sets up these like false expectations of what your life is supposed to be like. But then you're actually just spending your whole life watching movies and TV shows that tell you that you're not a real teenager. And so, yeah, I think I always had this really kind of meta complex obsessive relationship to popular culture. And then as I got older, you know, I feel like I found things that I really like almost imprinted on, like The Strokes' first album that was like absolutely huge for me. And I felt like before that and even like know about music, but then I found that band and, you know, not only did I want to like date all of those guys, I wanted to be them and I wanted to dress like them, but I wanted like to just be in that world. And so I started like dressing like maybe the kind of people that I wanted to date, which like doesn't actually look so good on like a 13-year-old girl with like giant hips. And, you know, who's wearing like 9 ties that she got from Value Village, or a shirt that she's like borrowing from her dad, and, you know, she's stealing his cover sneakers that are too big for her. But yeah, I just felt like was really dreaming of this other world. And then I was really looking to like, yeah, magazines were a huge part, like Spin magazine especially. I remember seeing The Strokes on the cover of Spin and I was shocked. I was like, I thought this was a band that I only knew about. They're on a cover of a magazine that I like am seeing at like Indigo. Yeah. And then that was a great sort of introduction to like indie rock. But it's like I had to kind of learn about everything through these like tactile, like actual forms of media, which don't exist anymore. Like, you know, and my whole culture relationship was about like physical objects and having to track down physical objects and buy them and own them and stuff, because you couldn't just steal or stream things. I sound like 100 years old, but
it's also telling that your film is set at an interesting and transitional time. Like literally the year it's set in, I think, is an interesting and transitional time for how we, what I'm getting at, I guess, is that the internet had existed by 2002-03 or whatever. It's 2003 roughly the film is set in. Is that correct?
2003-2004.
Yeah, yeah. And that obviously the internet had been around depending on what kind of access points you had to machines. The internet had been around for a good 7, 8, 9 years in a way. Email and stuff like that was happening, but that was around the point where, like, and we're going to get to this in a moment because I want to actually do ask you to summarize what I Like Movies is sort of about for people so I don't bungle it. But yeah, sorry, I've gone on a bit of a tangent of just trying to figure out why you've set this film, when you've set it, because it's also set in a video store, like a VHS sort of video store, which some people listening, who am I kidding? Most of my listeners are going to know exactly what we're talking about because they're also old, but younger people.
And there's a lot of DVDs.
And DVDs. Yes, of course. Sorry. Yeah, of course. That's what it, yeah, that's actually really what it was. Sorry about that. I'm confusing myself. My main thing here is, because I've gone on a ramble, I'm listening to you talk about being a preteen and wondering what it's like to be a teenager. And you're also immersing yourself in dreams of dating musicians and losing yourself in film. So there's some measure of imagination going on there, but I think there's also probably some measure of escapism. They're not intertwined, but I guess I wonder if you can ponder where that impulse came from of like, I can't wait to be somewhere else and someone else. I can't wait to be older. I can't wait to be, because that comes up in this film too. You have a couple of really precocious teens who want to be respected and want to be thought of as not only cool, but like mature. And even in the way they convey that, they seem narcissistic and immature, which is, you know, we're all trying to find ourselves at that point. But do you have a sense of why you couldn't wait to you were actually seeking out movies to figure out what your life might be like as a teenager? Like I would watch Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but never thought. I mean, to be honest, my mom's workplace people would say, if I call, they're like, what's Ferris up to? Because I would always play hooky. They'd always like, oh, is he sick again? Is he staying home? And I did do that quite a bit. But I never viewed that as aspirational. I didn't want to be Cameron or Ferris Bueller, but at the same time, maybe I did. I don't know. Anyway, enough about me. Do you know why you thought at that point, like, I got to be somewhere else and someone else? Do you know where that kind of comes from?
No, I think I felt that way like as a little kid. Like as a little kid, I was like, get me out of here.
And you wanted to be older, it sounds like.
I don't know if I wanted to be older, but I definitely wanted to be cool. Right. And I definitely wasn't. So, and I definitely like as a young kid had this really like strong streak of like needing like to express myself and perform and like be seen and understood and all the time. And I would like, you know, put on plays with like, make the like kids across the street from me. I'd be like, we're doing a play for our parents. And they're like, okay. And then I'd be like, here's your roles. And I'm going to put the Anne of Green Gables like musical soundtrack off. And we're going to choreograph a dance. And I remember like putting on these plays and my mom's like, is it over yet? I'm like, no, they're still going. And she's like, God. Well, you've been doing this for 15 minutes and I want it to be done.
Yeah, kids are the exact same. My son will be like, we made a play. I'm like, okay. And we're like, what is happening? So is it wanting to be the center of attention or more wanting to entertain people from your point of view?
These are some really heavy, like Marc Maron questions. I like it.
I'm insulted by this. I've been doing this a long time too. I ask good questions, I think, or whatever. They are a bit heavy. So.
No, this is a very good question. So I like it. Well, I think it was always like, yeah, I mean, I think it was this kind of need to be seen, I guess, or validated by people. And then I think the worst thing my mom would always say to me is that I was being attention seeking. And, you know, my parents would always kind of define things by negative attention and positive attention. So I think if I was being very like showboating and kind of annoying and performative, they would be like, you're trying to get negative attention right now, you know? And for them, like positive attention was like, you know, having a clean room and, you know, wearing washing my hair and doing my homework.
Positive attention always seems to be connected to chores. Have you noticed that?
Yeah. And I think I was just this really like kind of emotionally sensitive, kind of volatile, like super creative, but kind of chaotic mess, which I guess is Lawrence as well, you know?
I've had this over the years and I've tried to take it into consideration, because when you do something like you do, or like I do, where you have a byline and you're sharing mm-hmm. your thoughts, people do assume that you're doing it for some sort of ego gratification. And I can't deny that there's not something in there to that point. But since my wife and I, when we were in the mid-2000s, we started a college radio show in Guelph, and we would have guests on. I made a point of saying I wanted to do a segment at least once a week with an interview. And as such, I would promote the show, let people know that it was happening as best I could with the tools we had at the time, message boards, social media in its nascent forms, maybe. And invariably people would be like, oh man, you're just so self-promotional. I'm like, yeah, but I'm telling you that there's a guest on my show. I'm not telling you to listen to me monologue. I'm saying, I think this guest is cool. But I can tell you, Chandler, like there's just some sort of embittered, like, ah, oh, you're fucking full of yourself. I'm like, but it's all about the other person. So when I ask you if you feel like you were just trying to get attention or entertain people, those are different things, because to try to entertain mm-hmm. someone and hopefully lighten up their day, which is what I feel is what I hope. I'm just going to talk about myself a little bit to disprove that I'm a narcissist. But forgive me for a moment. I'm just meaning, like, for me, this thing you're on is really meant, as much as I'm talking too much, meant to be a platform to showcase you. And when I promote it, I don't say, or whatever, when I try to let people know about it, I try to say, I have this great guest on, I think is cool. I think you might think they're cool. Yes, I'm involved, but I have this sort of objective feeling about it. I know from feedback, people don't view it that way. Oh, it's all about you. Have you ever encountered this where people think, oh, you think you're so high and mighty as a critic? Oh, you're some fancy filmmaker now. And you're like, yeah, but I'm telling a story and I'm trying to, it's coming from some measure of empathy. Sorry, now I'm Mark Maroning myself, perhaps, but do you see where I'm coming from? Like, have you had these thoughts, or have you had that reception to your work where people assume it's about you and you're like, no. I love this film. I want to tell you about this film. Mm-hmm. That's why I wrote this nice review of it. Like, have you had that
right.
that conflict, or are people confronting you with stuff like that?
I don't think so. But I do think that, like, all criticism is essentially autobiography, right? Because it's about your own personal taste.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of times if I was kind of reviewing cultural objects and they struck a chord with me personally, I was maybe using those reviews to work out issues in my life that I was going through, maybe sometimes, unfortunately, against the cultural object themselves, where they were
yeah.
a little bit of a punching bag because, you know, I've just gone through a breakup or
absolutely. Sometimes I come across an old review I wrote of something, and if it's negative, I'm like, I wonder what was happening to me that day.
Yeah, which is so interesting, right? But it's like, what art is made for humans, so... Yeah. How can you not expect the people? I mean, that's what you want. You want, like, the subjectivity, I think, in someone's personal relationship to an object. Otherwise, all our criticism would just be like either this kind of mass consensus that is kind of like an algorithmic kind of like decision, like, oh, okay, Rotten Tomatoes is like evaluating all the reviews and this is the worth of it. But I, you know, really beautiful criticism that like really struck me, and the kind of writers I always wanted to emulate, like Pauline Kael or Lester Bangs or Chuck Klosterman, like they really, I think that was for me what excited me about criticism and why I hated my academic education in film school, like studying film through a purely academic lens, because there was no personal approach to it. And it wasn't fun and subjective. It was like very analytical and dry and kind of theoretical. And for me, I've always like, the reason I love criticism is, yeah, kind of as a way to have a form of self-expression. I mean, it's weird to kind of do it through the lens of other people's art.
Yeah.
And clearly I was kind of burying and repressing this desire to like make my own films, probably because of that nagging voice from my parents of being like, stop. Nobody wants to hear this, you know?
Well, more than any letter section though, like you were talking about how there's like 900 reviews of something when it comes out now.
Mm-hmm.
Have you noticed with social media the instantaneous critique of the critic? Like the hot take, oh. Like the critic or whoever, the newspaper, the magazine, whatever posts the review. And then there's this whole other genre of criticizing the review. And I've, that's an interest. Have you encountered that in your work?
I mean, sometimes if it's really off base or, you know, like a really stupid take, it is kind of fun to see people be like, who does this person think he is?
Yeah, that's what I'm encountering.
Or like this criticism is mother, like this review of like, there's also that. I feel like there's the lexicon of, I don't know, the osmosis of exploring culture through Twitter. It's like this weird, hazy, like stream of consciousness thing where.
Well, my son is only 11. They will often talk to me about movie scenes. And I'm like, when did you watch that movie? And I realized it's just through memes. Like they'll be like, haha, Walter White. I'm like, how have you watched Breaking Bad? I would not have permitted that. Yeah. And I'm your father. I haven't seen it. It's a meme. I'm like, oh, okay. Anyway, yeah, it's a weird time for consumption because people don't feel they need that. They feel like the soundbite has fulfilled them and they know everything about a topic based on the meme or the soundbite. So, One quick thing I thought of as we were just talking about criticism is, because you invoked earlier, like conflict of interest. I'm a reviewer and now I'm also making the films. Do you not think though that, by articulating your thoughts about films or music over the years, slowly but surely, like your body and your mind are developing a kind of, here's what I like, here's what I don't like about this realm. So then when you go into it, you've basically been writing little diary entries about what you like about film for years and years and years. Do you find that that informs your approach to like making it, not the pressure of like, I don't want to do the things I hate, but maybe just intrinsically, inherently, because you've articulated so much of what you like and don't like, do you think that impacts you as someone actually, as a practitioner of the form?
Yeah, I really like the way you put that, little diary entries, because I do think it's true. Like, I think I really developed my taste, which I think is such a fundamental part to making films, right? Because at the beginning of making any kind of art, like all you have is your taste, you know, and then you also kind of have to do the execution, like the hard work of like, you know, what like Malcolm Gladwell says, like the 10,000 hours of actually like putting it into practice, you know, you need to edit those, your mom's friend's video of her yoga studio and, you know, the music video that you shoot for $100,000 for your friend and, you know, and write, you know, 7 scripts that don't get made, like all that stuff ends up kind of bleeding into your work. I remember my friend Jeremy had this like beautiful metaphor about how it's like on one side of, it's like a triangle, and like on one side of the pyramid is like, you know, all of the art that you admire and all the movies that changed your life and all the profound experiences you had, kind of like knowing yourself and knowing your taste. And then on the other side is like, yeah, all the, you know, footage you log and the interviews you transcribe and like the humiliations you endure pitching things that don't get made. And like stuff you do for hire. And then the stuff that's like really gratifying and artistically fulfilling. And then at the top of the pyramid is hopefully like getting paid well to do stuff that you love. And a lot of people like don't ever get to meet, I guess, that top of the triangle sometimes, but that's like the goal, right? It's this kind of like good combination of like making your own art that you feel has integrity to it, but then also being able to, you know, survive as an artist and make a living at it too.
Yeah. You may not know that you're training yourself by engaging even in the realm of, you know, have you had a glance at Quentin Tarantino's latest book? I think it's called Cinema Speculation. Have you read that at all?
No, I haven't read it.
Are you a fan of his?
I love Tarantino, but I don't know if I want to read that book. Maybe in a bit.
It's pretty fascinating in terms of how much and how young he was when he was exposed to pretty intense films.
Mm-hmm.
And the ways he, like between his, he seemed to have, I guess sort of a broken home situation. So he would just be, his mother would take him to films like Dirty Harry, like just stuff when he was like a kid. And somehow we would, I guess there was no MPAA. There was no like, no, you can't come into this, you know, film. I'm sorry. I was just asking, I was just trying to talk about exposure to film because I just found that fascinating. In your case too, like I say, the training thing, just going to see films and like how it informs what you do as a filmmaker, I assume is part of it. So let's get to it. Tell us if in your own words, what I Like Movies is about, if you can.
Sure. Well, it's kind of this sort of Joker origin story of this very pretentious young teenage boy who's obsessed with cinema named Lawrence Queller. He's named after Ben Queller, my favorite musician. And he gets a job in a video store in his hometown of Burlington, Ontario, to save money for what he thinks is going to be his future life as an NYU film student. And then he forms a very complicated relationship with his older female manager at the store.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. And this is, I saw in a tweet of yours, like, I don't know if I'm paraphrasing, it was like, move over, Fablemans, which I thought was funny. This is your origin story to some extent?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot that's like very heavily fictionalized and complete fiction, but I did work at Blockbuster in high school. I was very pretentious and I didn't have like a kind of deep relationship with the manager there. But there's a lot of kind of like the shell of it that's really true to my own experiences. And it's a very personal film.
And how many films have you made at this point?
This is my first feature film.
It's remarkable. I made one short before that. You made a short. Where do you get the audacity to make such a brilliant first film? Like, it's really brilliant. I'm like, how is this the first film? But seriously, I mean, how do you, I know this is going to maybe seem banal, but Chandler, I'm just very impressed. As a first film, it seems fully realized. How did this happen? How did you have this idea? And then who got behind this? How did this work?
Yeah, I mean, it was just made because Telefilm has this Talent to Watch grant. It's like a micro-budget grant for first features. And I was really, like, I felt like I was in my early 30s and I really wanted to make a movie. And, you know, Lady Bird had come out and that movie struck such a deep chord with me. And I would watch, like, behind-the-scenes footage of, like, Greta Gerwig directing Lady Bird and I would just cry. Like, I just felt like it was almost like I feel like the way that women know when they're, like, ready to have a child, like, I need to be a mother. Like, who's going to get me pregnant? But yeah. I felt that way about like making a movie. Like, I was like, I'm ready to make a film. I need to make a movie or I'm going to die. And I was trying to get this other movie off the ground, but the budget was like $1 million. And, you know, I couldn't get anybody to read the script. I couldn't like get an actress to read it. I couldn't get, you know, Telefilm was like, yeah, we're interested if you can, like assure us that the other $700,000 is already raised. And I was like, so it just felt like this like impossible thing. I felt like I was going to be waiting, you know, to ask for permission for the rest of my life. You know, no one was ever going to give it to me. So I found out about this grant. It was like $125,000. I was like, okay, like just think of an idea that you could execute for that amount of money. And like,
yeah,
maybe it's not going to be like perfect, but it's an opportunity to like, try this out, this dream of yours, like write something that's pretty contained, like use it almost like a second film school where you can learn how to work with actors. Also at that time, I'd never written anything that I felt was actually authentic to my own voice and experiences.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I'd been a critic for so long and I made the short film, but it was kind of more of an adaptation of a novel. And I felt like I found my way into it, but it didn't feel like urgently personal to me or risky in the same way. And I guess I just, in my entire life, I'd never made any personal art ever.
Right.
Other than maybe like personal essays and kind of like cultural criticism stuff. But it's not the same thing, you know. So then I was like, okay, I'm doing this. And then we had to shoot it during the pandemic.
Oh, you did shoot it during the pandemic. I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah. Yeah, at the most dangerous possible time to be shooting in Ontario. At the height of the third wave when like the case counts were really spiking.
Why did you,
before there were vaccines available.
Oh my God. Why did you do that? Why didn't you had to do it then, I guess.
Yeah. It was just kind of like the way that the cookie crumbled. We didn't want to keep waiting. And you know, at that time, everything was so uncertain. So it just felt like, I don't know, maybe if we keep waiting, things will get better, but who knows? This could be going on for the rest of our lives.
Tell us a little bit about these performers, because they seem to have a lot of work to do. Every relationship in this film is very intense. The scenes are all pretty much, even the ones with some levity, are very intense, or there's like, what's coming next? Can you talk a little bit about these performers by name? I want to give you an opportunity to name them, and any insights about them that we might benefit from, or even things they brought to it that surprised you in terms of how they play these characters.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's just such an incredible ensemble of actors, and I feel really lucky to have worked with all of them. Isaiah Letnin, who's like the lead actor who plays Lawrence, it's his first time ever kind of being the leading role of anything before, too.
Remarkable. That is remarkable.
And he had such a difficult job to do. I mean, he has like, he never stops talking. He probably has like 17 monologues in the film. He's in almost every single shot of the movie. He has to play this very difficult, insufferable kind of teen boy, but then I think he imbues them with so much like nuance and complexities, like an innately kind of sympathetic, charismatic person.
And
he really is. He had to kind of embody the whole tone of the movie. Like if you cast the wrong actor in that part, like the movie just doesn't work. So I did this this Canada-wide casting search with this amazing casting director, Jesse Griffiths. And, you know, there was like, it was all over Zoom. So I never got to meet anybody in person. And, you know, saw a lot of really interesting like iterations of the character, some really great actors, but there was just something about Isaiah. He's just like instantly nailed it, and he worked really, really hard. And then Romina Dugo, who plays Alana, is also just really, really fantastic. She's also hasn't had a leading role in a movie in like, she's only had one like in the early 2000s.
Yeah, remarkable.
And she used to be a competitive dancer, so she's on the first season of So You Think You Can Dance, Canada.
There's at least one scene where she gets to exhibit some dancing, and I was like, oh, she's got some moves, actually. That's really good.
Yeah, she's amazing. And she actually also does she is a choreographer, too. So she choreographed the dance scenes in Suicide Squad, Margot Robbie and Jared Leto. But she's just unbelievable, too. And I think the two of them together are just great. And then Krista Bridges, who plays Lawrence's mom, Terry, had been in the short scene that I had written when I was at the Canadian Film Center. And I loved her performance in that. I thought she was so great. And so, you know, just kind of offered the role to her. But she only came on like 2 weeks before we were supposed to start shooting.
Oh, wow.
So, and I thought like she really, really nailed it.
Absolutely.
And then
yeah.
Percy Hines-White, who's on the Wednesday, the Netflix show. Yeah, he's so great, too.
He played Lawrence's friend?
Yeah, his best friend, Matt McCarter.
Wonderful. So this is, it's just an incredible ensemble, and the story is so jarring and moving and intense and funny, and I really enjoyed it. I alluded to the fact that it was set maybe 20 years ago, and I wonder, so there'll be people encountering this film, younger people who are like, video rental, DVD rental, rental fees. Like there's just some thing, and that's like the rental fees is like a major bone of contention. I don't want to ruin anything, but why set it? I know it's about you. I know it's coming of age story for you, but what prompted you to set it in sort of, let's face it, kind of technologically anyway, a bygone era?
Yeah. I mean, I just think, well, A, it's a video store, so there's not much shelf life afterwards. I mean, they were kind of like going extinct towards like 2007 already. So there's not too many, you know, many years left to kind of set it in. But that's also, when I went to high school. So I think I just wanted it to be as authentic as possible to my own personal experiences. And, you know, it's just so fun to make a period piece and kind of rekindle these memories of what it was like to grow up in Southern Ontario in the early aughts and kind of really pay homage to this kind of like weird Canadiana that people might not remember anymore, like the Big Shiny Tunes anthologies or the Oliver the Cashman commercial, or you know, Lawrence's sneakers are from like Adbusters magazine. There's just like a lot of fun Easter eggs, and you know, a time in cinema that was maybe more pure for cinephiles.
What about SNL? SNL is a recurring it's something that the Lawrence and his buddy there, Matt, they bond over. What did that?
Yeah.
Why? And it's not just once. That's like a key part of their friendship. I will tell you, and I still, one of my gigs, by the way, still is to review SNL every week.
Wow.
And that's a weird one. I've been doing it for a long time for Exclaim. But
that's awesome.
Yeah, it's something. But I've been watching that show. Okay, just real quick. For me, I was exposed to that show because my parents, my mother's brothers and sister lived in Scarborough, Ontario. So we lived in Cambridge. So almost every weekend, I want to say, there would be some convoy of... They'd either come to Cambridge. Very rarely would they come to see us, to be honest. We would go there, and my parents would lose track of time. So we wouldn't leave till like 1 in the morning, which meant would watch SNL at my cousin's house, and that's how I first discovered it as a kid. Like, so 1986 or something like that. I was like, what is this show? What? It seems dangerous. Why is this on the television? And then I got kind of hooked. So I just want to say, everyone disparages it. I also, I critique it with some measure of, why is this not as good as it could be? Like, I'm trying to be objective. It's not a pure passion thing. What does that show mean to you now? And what did it mean to you at that point in your life?
I mean, it was everything to me in high school. And, you know, it almost made like Saturday nights. Like, it was like a thrill to, you know, get to stay up and watch it. And as soon as I guess I first started watching it in kind of the Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Anna Gasteyer years. Yeah. And then after, I remember, and I would watch it on sleepovers with my friends and that were literally called Rejects Night. And then after...
Oh, that was a real... Yeah. You really called it Rejects Night? That's cute. That's funny.
And then after the episode would be over, they would air like a rerun from SNL afterwards on, I think, on Global. So I think they'd go in chronological order. So it was weird because, you know, sometimes it would be the 70s, but then it would get into like the horrible 80s, like Joe Piscopo years.
Yeah.
And then the 90s, which were so great because that was like the Adam Sandler, you know, Chris Farley.
Norm
McDonald. Of course.
Yeah.
I hope you appreciate my Norm respect.
There's a Norm. Oh, yeah. There's a, yes. Sorry. There's a Jimmy Fallon dig, which, no offense, I'll just say that on your behalf. I'm happy to offend. But yes, that's a great little thank you. Yes, I laughed at that out loud.
I love
and
Norm.
Actually said out loud to my wife, Norm, like a child, like a kid.
Oh,
Norm.
That's so sweet.
It mentioned Norm. Well, I love, as you may know, I'm a big Norm fan. So yeah, sorry, continue.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It just like, it totally shaped my whole life. And then, you know, it kind of coincided brilliantly with like Tina Fey then taking that show over and, you know, Mean Girls coming out. And I think for me, a young woman who wanted to be a comedy writer who had brown hair and glasses, you know, Tina Fey was like my, like, Mick Jagger. Like, I couldn't believe that she existed, that she was so funny. I couldn't believe she's such an amazing writer. Mean Girls needs to be on the Criterion Collection. It's a masterpiece. And, you know, I just think her sense of humor really resonated, struck a chord with me, and then her as a performer too. So then that really, that show, I think, with also kind of the female lens of her becoming the head writer of SNL, really, really, like, I was like, damn, this is my everything. You know?
I gather that this is an important, Romina's character, I feel like, represents some commentary, not just some, this is a character that I think represents the plight of women, and I feel like that's something that was very important to you as you were. And then there's also this. Sorry, I forget her name. The young aspiring and talented cinematographer. Lauren P. Sorry, I knew it was initial there. Lauren P. Yeah, this is important to you, right? Like this idea of exploring what it meant to be a woman or a young girl in this era, dealing with really fragile men whose fragility makes them hateful and controlling. Sorry, maybe I'm articulating it for you, but it was important for you to try to figure out a way to convey what that experience was like for women and how horrible they were treated by people like Lawrence and others.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the whole popular culture in general was like all about humiliating women in the late to early 2000s, right? And pitting them against each other and having this horrible, you know, beauty standard that like nobody could meet, and, you know, psychologically traumatizing and slut shaming women. And, you know, you see sort of like what happened to Britney Spears during that era. And a lot of these like pop cultural icons from that time, you know?
Yeah.
Lindsay Lohan, you know, and Brittany Murphy. So yeah, I mean, I feel like, yeah, it was just a ghastly time to be a woman then. And there was nothing for us, you know, I had to, you know, when I was like growing up, like, yeah, the only things that I felt like I related to, I mean, it was like watching Woody Allen movies and like reading myself into Woody Allen, like, yeah. You know, watching Manhattan as like a 13-year-old and being like, oh, I connect to this. It's like so bizarre to think about that now. But there was just like nothing for me. And even when I went to university, I mean, there was kind of no canon where any female filmmakers were being really studied or celebrated on the syllabus of any of the classes that I took. So there's so many female filmmakers that if I had known about them then, it would have been like really important and lightning rods for me, but they just weren't even discussed. And so I think that's why maybe I think I've as a cultural critic too, like as a really young woman writing about culture at a pretty vulnerable age when all of my mentors and bosses and the people I was kind of developing friendships with and work relationships with are all older men, you know, in their 30s and 40s. And I look back at that time now and I'm like, was that okay? You know, and all the art that I was writing about was all created by men and stuff too. I mean, I was like a really young staff writer at iWeekly, like 22 years old, like one of, you know, two women on the staff. And the amount of kind of scrutiny and, you know, misogyny just by people in their responses to the articles that I was writing was really intense at the time. And I don't think I handled it well. But I, you know, but there was nobody to be like, this isn't okay. Or are you okay? Like, it was really strange.
Well, for what it's worth, and I mean, I don't exactly know how you did this. This film to me is a bit of a magic trick because you've got a lot of different ideas interweaving beautifully. Romina's sort of monologue about her time in Hollywood is remarkable. Mm. And all I'm getting at is, you've left and created space for so many different kinds of ideas about family and about culture and misogyny and narcissism and selfishness and pain. Like, it's, sorry, I'm just rambling, but I just want to commend you because I was not expecting this when I put the movie on. I'd been glancing at what, I try not to read too much before I read a book or, you know, listen to a record. I try to process things myself, but I was very happy for you to see how, because that's the other part of this film is are you surprised by how well this film has resonated with people and is being received by people?
Yeah, absolutely, because I think I made it in such a bubble, you know, and I think what was great about it was that I wasn't thinking about any of that stuff. I was just kind of really operating in this sort of modicum of like pure joy and sort of thinking about things that I thought were beautiful or funny or interesting, and I wasn't like, oh, how is this going to connect with like viewers or what's like the marketing potential of any of this stuff? Which I think is why it has connected with people, because it's just so specific to my own experience that's what kind of makes it universal.
Has there been one particularly thrilling, if you could pick one, I should say, I'm sure there's been more than one. Has there been one particularly exciting bit of feedback or like, oh my God, I can't believe so-and-so watched my film. Do you have anything like that?
Oh yeah. I mean, Sarah Polley has just been such a generous champion of the movie.
Oh, nice.
And it's been absolutely insane. And I remember I sent her like a link to the film, and then, you know, I wasn't sure if she was ever going to watch it, you know, which is totally fine. Full respect. She's on like an Oscar campaign around the world.
Yeah, she's, yeah.
And then I was in Norway at a film festival, and I checked my phone, and she sent me an email being like, Chandler, I have COVID and I've watched your movie and it's a masterpiece and you're an incredible director. And it was just, and like, if there's any way that I can help support the movie, like I really, really love it. And you just did such an amazing job and I'm actually going to watch it again and tonight. And I was like,
oh, wow.
And I was almost in tears, like to kind of, cause I think making the movie was so hard that to have someone who you look up to so much, that's such a hero of yours, that like literally lives in the same city as you and is such an incredible talent, like to have that kind of vote of confidence in your work meant a lot to me. And then since then, yeah, she just keeps tweeting about it like over and over
That's
again.
That's great. That's wonderful.
And I was like, this is unbelievable, you know, like the day after her Oscar win, there's like, she posted a picture of herself with her Oscar, but she's like, but never mind, just watch I Like Movies by Taylor. And I was like, what?
Oh my God. That is amazing. Well, it's, like I say, for what it's worth, I don't know. My wife was like, how do you know? I was like, yeah, it's my, I tend to drop the word friend too much. And I'm like, that's my, I said, yeah, it's my friend, my colleague, Chandler's movie. You know this person? I'm like, yeah. And then I was like, how do I know Chandler? And I'm like, she asked me, and I'm like, I guess just from around, right? Like, is that how you?
Oh, we were writing at I at the same time and definitely.
But I never went to the office. Like, I never really did. Like, I was in Guelph, you know? Like, I was like, how do we know each other? I don't even know.
Well, we have lots of friends in common and, you know, part of the same scene and kind of trajectory.
We've been in the same rooms. We sat together at a Pop Montreal thing. Like, I just I don't know how I know anyone. I just, I'm like, yeah, we're just in the same places and we do the same things. Totally. Anyway, I didn't mean to get into that. One quick thing before we wrap up, because I always marvel at comedians and filmmakers and authors who tap into their own real life experience for their expression. I'm like, how do you figure out if you've, particularly for someone like you, like, you've said a lot about yourself in this film, mm-hmm. and it's resonating with people. And like you said earlier, this felt particularly authentic to you. Mm-hmm. Do you have a next project in mind? And if so, is it another, like, what part of my life might be fodder for a film? Like, have you had these sort of thoughts yet?
Oh, yeah. I have another one, like, ready to go that I'm really hoping I get. I just applied to Telefilm with funding for it. And it's going to be produced by Matt Johnson and Matt Miller, who did Nirvana and the Band, the Show, and Blackberry that was just at Berlin, and I've been writing that script for about since 2015, so it's kind of a long time coming. But yeah, that one's kind of takes place in 2011, so I'm slowly but surely edging up to contemporary society.
But it's about it's drawn from your own life.
Yeah,
in some way?
It's sort of a portrait of like the Montreal music scene in the early. In 2011, kind of when Grimes and Mac DeMarco were playing these tiny loft shows. And that's when I was living there for the first time when I was 24. You know, it was like a young female music critic. So kind of investigates the idea of like why women date guys in bands. Is it because we want to be guys in bands? And sort of the kind of weird, toxic, you know, undercurrents of that scene and the alienation of being like an Anglophone in Montreal and living in this place that doesn't actually want you there. And then, but it's like very much like a romantic comedy and kind of a hangout movie.
And, you know, I studied film in the 90s, and parts of those courses were a heavy focus on Canadian filmmaking. And I'm always struck by just how deeply Canadian certain filmmakers, they stick to that. Like, they're set in Canada.
Yeah.
Their references. The other thing that made me chuckle, by the way, is the numerous references to Guelph. And I Like Movies, and I just love that. Yeah. As you know, I lived there for a long time, and I still miss it. But
he's not a reliable narrator, so you know, hopefully
that's
no
true.
One will take offense.
Yeah, but my point was that is a choice that you're making that could limit and narrow. Maybe this might be old world thinking. That regionalism might limit the appeal to an American audience or something like that. Mm-hmm. But did you ever even have a fleeting thought of like, maybe I shouldn't be so Canadian with this so that it resonates beyond like no one's, most people listening will be like, what was that word? Guelph? What does that even mean? Yeah. Yeah.
The stakes were so low with this movie. I mean, it was like, it's not like I had like foreign investors in China being like, cast Jason Statham as Lawrence, you know.
That would have been an interesting choice.
So, yeah, I think he would have been great, you know, really considered it. He was tech avail, I think the thrill of like all kinds of Canadian culture and the Canadian culture that really has always struck a chord with me and the Canadian culture that's really traveled really far has been actually the regionality and specificity of setting, like in a really uncompromising way. I mean, that's why like Quebec cinema so you know celebrated all over the world, because you know Quebec filmmakers are really audacious and they never hide where they're from. They just you know, revel in it. And that's why their, you know, film economy and box office is actually quite healthy, because they have their own star system and they actually go and watch their own movies. You know, Guy Madden's depiction of Winnipeg, I love so much. Yeah. Like the Kids in the Hall depiction of, you know, Toronto in the 90s.
Yep.
Alice Munro, the way that she writes about like Southwestern Ontario in her short stories, you know, Mordecai Richler's like portrayal of like Mile End and Montreal, like in music, you know, like the New Pornographers are such a Vancouver band and Arcade Fire is such a Montreal Quebec band, and they're singing in French and in Haitian and stuff, you know? So I just don't understand why we have to make it this amorphous kind of bland thing where we have like American currency and are just trying to disguise everything. Cause like, then we have nothing, like we don't have the budget, we don't have the actors, and then you don't even have any kind of sense of place or anything to hold your hat on. Like, why do you want to watch a movie or read a book that doesn't feel like anywhere?
I was just trying to invoke the personality and mindset of a 1990s promotional person being like, do you really want, why can't we set this in Boston? You know what I mean? Like, I fully appreciate and understand why you would set it where you would. And I'm not questioning it. I just wonder if you ever questioned it in terms of.
No, I think I just always want to like double down on that, I think. You know, and I think there's so many really fascinating parts of Canada that really need to be like immortalized. And I guess what the thrill of doing it with Burlington is that it is this very bland, you know, kind of place. But most of Canada actually looks like that. It doesn't look like the four places where Canadian films are always set, which is like Toronto, a fishing village in Newfoundland, or like, you know, someplace that's pretending to be Montreal or New York, you know, it's.
Yeah. Lord knows we've learned a lot about Montreal if we've read books by Heather O'Neill or the Prairies from Miriam Taves. Like, it's not.
I
feel like I'm tapped into those places right away as soon as I dig in. And I mean, think of a place like New Jersey, like where, you know, the people who are from there really champion it. The likes of, obviously, well, I don't know if
Zach Braff, Bruce Springsteen,
Kevin Smith, like, you know, speaking of a video store proponent or whatever. Yeah, like, I think there's something, I never thought twice about it, but I think as a kid when I would see.
Or Douglas Copeland.
In Vancouver. Absolutely, yeah. So, sorry, there is a long tradition of it. I appreciate you being a part of it and doing something that's true to you. And I think that's the main thing you're probably saying. Like, why the hell would I set this anywhere else? This is where you literally shot it, where you were raised. Like, that's amazing that you could do that. And
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think everybody has a really complicated relationship to where they're from, their hometown, right? And it's always kind of a push and pull kind of thing. But it's very deeply meaningful to me. I mean, I remember when we did a day of shooting exteriors in Burlington, and I had this, it was me and my cinematographer, and we had these like Panavision lenses, and we're just kind of driving around Burlington with a van, like filming outside of the window and stuff. And I remember we wrapped, and we actually wrapped at a restaurant, and we went for dinner at this restaurant that was in the same exact plaza where I'd worked at in Blockbuster. Oh. So, which is now at Tim Hortons. So I could like see literally like the place that I worked at as a teenager, like out the window, you know?
Yeah.
And it was just this really meaningful thing of like being like, I can't believe that, you know, the person who was walking around this Blockbuster in a sash that said Spider-Man 2 available now on DVD, you know, asking people if they had a membership, like that person would have never believed that like 15 years later they would be with their camera crew, like, you know, having wrapped their first feature film. Like, so I don't know. I just think it's like, there's so many songs to be sung about Canada, and in really interesting, multifaceted, complex ways. You know, it doesn't have to just be hardcore Canadiana, like where we're just celebrating Canada as this country that doesn't have any problems. Like, I think there's a lot of really fascinating movies that have been made in the past few years, and even this year, that really delve into kind of the complexities of it with a lot of humor and urgency and really cinematic vibrancy. So it's an exciting time.
Well, I apologize if the question came across as disparaging or whatever. I think sometimes when you're so close to a place, it's hard to see the magic in it. And that's coming from my perspective.
Yeah.
I actually, at one point, thinking about the various trips I would have to take to Toronto from Guelph on the train, I never even encountered the name Aldershot until it showed up and like next stop, Aldershot. I'm like, Aldershot, where are we? Milton? What is that? And then it comes up in your movie, Aldershot. And I'm like, Aldershot. I know that just from traveling on the train line, not driving. I don't think there's a sign on the 401, the major highway in Ontario, that even says Aldershot. Is there? I don't think there is.
I mean, there's a GO train stop.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like, that's what I remember.
It's a neighborhood in Burlington. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I want to wrap this up. I've taken this down a circuitous route off the train tracks. I'm sorry.
We covered a lot of ground,
We did.
Holocaust.
We did.
Trauma.
There's no need to summarize it. I'll put little podcast notes in and people can figure it out for themselves. Chandler, I want to do some business here. If people want to access or see this remarkable movie that you've made, where can they learn more about it and how can they do that?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, right now it's playing in select theaters across Canada. So I guess you could Google the name of the film and maybe what city you live in and see if the showtimes pop up. You can also follow us on Instagram. I think we're ilikemovies_themovie for updated info, or just slide into my DMs and I'll tell you what's up.
Okay.
Yeah. And the film will also be available to rent on VOD via Mongrel Media, I think in about 6 weeks. So if you miss it in a theater, you can always rent it online through all channels. But it's really, really fun to watch in an audience, especially, after in a post-pandemic landscape. It's like a great comedy. It plays well with an audience. So
yeah,
would mean a lot if you watched it and let me know what you thought of it.
And then potentially streaming service stuff might come up at some point. Like you mentioned the renting, but maybe.
Oh, yeah. It'll be available on Netflix Canada in September.
Oh, congratulations. That's great.
Thank September. You. But that's, don't wait
that long. Yeah. Okay. And and if people want to follow you or learn more about you per se?
If you want to step into my my darkened corners of my mind, if this podcast didn't alienate you enough, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Clevac, C-L-E-V as in Victor, A-C-K.
Yeah, I'll link to all these things in the podcast description so people can just click on them. Chandler, sorry if this was too dark and alienating, but I hope you enjoyed yourself and we got to some good stuff. And it was a pleasure to speak with you. And for what it's worth, I'm proud of you. I'm not your father,
but I
feel like our brother or anything, or uncle. I just feel proud of you and I'm happy for you.
That's so sweet.
I just am. I don't know what else to say. It's how I feel when my friends and colleagues are doing well. I'm excited. And this is just such a remarkable achievement. I like movies. I can't wait to see what you do next. Thank you for this. I hope you had fun and best of luck in the future.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a fantastic podcast and I'm an honor to be a part of it.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Oh, very special thanks again to Chandler Levac for appearing on this, the 762nd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you've heard about and you're looking for it, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can also like Creative Control on Facebook or follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Instagram and on Twitter at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to support me and the work I do on this podcast. That's the primary source of revenue for all of the work that goes into making this show for you each and every week, it seems. I think that's pretty much accurate. Did I miss a week? I don't think I have. Anyway, it's a fair amount of work, and it's not a lot of revenue, and it's nice to do it. I like doing the show, don't get me wrong, but if you feel like you've got some dough and you want to put it towards something that you like and you like this show, well, head over to patreon.com/creativecontrol and make your pledge today. $6 or more American a month grants you access to exclusive content, and you also get episodes earlier than everybody else. And if you'd like, if you want to receive a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon and I'll get you one while supplies last. It doesn't have to be $6 American. It could be $6 Italian, or it could be anything really. And you can change it at any point. You could make it one thing and then you can make it higher. You can make it $10 after it was at $6, or you can make it $4 after it was at $6. You can make it $200 a month. Whatever you can afford and feel compelled to send my way to support the show. Means a lot. Again, patreon.com/creativecontrol to make your flexible monthly donation today. Thank you so much. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks as always to my friend Jim Guthrie for lending me some music of his for this show. You can learn more about Jim and his wonderful world of music at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you so much for listening to this episode with Chandler Levack. I hope you'll check out this brilliant new film. I like movies. It's really, really moving and funny and hard and all the good things. I mean, really, it'll change you a little bit. I tell you, you'll leave altered after the film's done. So thank you to Chandler, and thank you to you again for listening to this episode and for subscribing to it or following the show and telling your friends about it and spreading the word about Creative Control. It means a lot. All right, I'm going to go. I will talk to you very soon, I hope. Be well. Bye for now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.